From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Richard LaTendresse, White House correspondent for TVA Nouvelle, and Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Our moderator is Washington correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports, Paul Brandes.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. Democrats zero in on the Mueller report. President Trump threatens to close the Mexican border. Republicans back off from a health care plan, and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, also known as NATO, marks its 70th anniversary. Well, let's start with this Mueller report. You know, it's been a couple of weeks now since Attorney General William Barr released this four-page summary of the report, which we also know is now about 400 pages long. It looked into possible collusion between the president and his staffers and Russia during the campaign. Barr said no collusion, but he did not clear Trump on this issue of possible obstruction of justice. And that's why, Richard, these Democrats are really anxious to get their hands on this 400-page report. What's going on with that?
Well, now they want the full report unredacted. At the moment, the Attorney General, William Barr, is working on it. He was asked for the report on April the 2nd. He said, I'm going to give it to you. The version that I'll give it to you will be for mid-April. But while waiting for this redacted version of the 400-some pages of the report, the House Judiciary Committee on Partisan Line has voted to subpoena the full report, because it looks, different sources told the New York Times first and other media afterwards, that investigators within the Mueller team are frustrated by William Barr's four-page summary. I think we can say this, as you were underlining the fact that we've had the report for 2 weeks. The perception has been shaped by these four pages, and apparently it fails to correctly transcribe or gives a clear idea of the conclusions of the investigators.
Nihal, your thoughts on what's going on with all this?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to make clear, Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee, or the Judiciary Committee, they voted to authorize the subpoena. They haven't quite yet issued the subpoena, but this is a warning shot. And yeah, they want the full report. They want it unredacted. And I think part of the reason is that you're hearing all these frustrations via, you know, intermediaries from Mueller aides and others saying, we don't think that Barr quite got across the gravity of the things that we found when we were investigating this issue. And Barr has said he's going to release the report, but his version will have some redactions, and that's caused some frictions over the issue. So I think that what we're going to see over the next few weeks, as people anticipate either a release of this report or a subpoena that forces some sort of a release, you're going to see the president become more and more worried and more agitated, as the narrative, which originally set in that made it look like he was fine, and which he declared was, you know, in a full exoneration of him, as this starts to shift.
Now, President Trump, of course, has said all along, at least talking about this alleged collusion, which we now think did not happen, that he's totally off the hook here. But as you point out, that is not the case on this possible, we have to emphasize, issue of obstruction of justice. The president continues to say that he's done nothing wrong. And he also says, interestingly now, that Mr. Mueller over the last 2 years acted, quote, honorably. So no matter what comes out in that report now, it's going to be hard for Trump to walk back that honorably.
No, it's going to be tough for him. But at the moment, he is really trying to put the blame on the Democrats being overzealous. There was this tweet saying it's the highest level of presidential harassment in the history of our country. So there's this will to show his supporters that there has been a two-year-long inquiry. Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, underlying the fact that she claims that they have to show for the 2 years they've spent of their life, they have something to show for this. They've spent working on this. The president is going to probably use The fact that we're continuing talking about this as a reason for going back behind him and supporting him in his way of continuing the administration he's managing at the moment.
Can I make a couple of points here? I don't actually think it'll be that hard for Trump to walk back his recent praise of Bob Mueller. I mean, President Trump has a history of flip-flopping on any number of things, sometimes within the same paragraph. So I think he'll just change. And I think a lot of his supporters will switch sides with him no matter which way he goes. But that being said, look, if so far you're a Republican and you've been saying, look, based on Barr's summary, everything's fine. There's been an exoneration. There's no collusion. And now you're going to argue, no, you can't release the report in full. Well, if you're afraid of the report, then why? I mean, we thought you just said it was perfectly fine.
And so, especially if you say you've done nothing wrong, then why fear the release of this report? It doesn't make sense. Interesting. Well, moving on, the president also is threatening to close the Mexican border, which he says is overrun by he calls them illegal immigrants. Others call them undocumented immigrants. The president has declared this national emergency. There's been resistance to actually shutting down the border, which he wants, including from business groups along the border who say this would be really bad for the economy. Nahal, what happens next?
Well, the president just yesterday said that he's going to give Mexico a year to try to calm things down, to stem the flow of drugs, and to clamp down on migration. And that then if that doesn't happen, then he's going to use tariffs to try to punish Mexico over this. And that eventually he might shut down the border. Now, look, this is essentially a backtrack by the president. He, you know, waves this threat of closing the border. He gets a ton of backlash, including from a lot of Republicans who say, look, this will be devastating to trade. You can't do this. And so he's now walking this back, and he's now giving it a year. And I guarantee you, in a year, it'll be more closer in the election season. So who knows? This could come back in a fury, or he could try to take it a completely different direction and hope that we forget that we ever had this conversation.
And he's giving them a year's warning, which a year from now, I mean, who knows what's going to happen. Richard, what is the threat of tariffs on autos? What does that have to do with immigration?
Well, it's interesting because during the week, it was the week on this topic, like on the following one, actually, a week of confusion with capital C, because he started the week saying for sure he was going to impose 100%, it's his expression, impose a closing of the border. And then he backtracked because of business leaders, because of elected officials. John Kennedy, the senator from Louisiana, talking about $2 billion a day of loss for the American economy. So he backtracked, put the blame on Congress, who needed to close loopholes that allow people to come in and stay in the country. And finally, he comes up with this one-year notice with tariffs on the Mexican car industry. But we just signed, hasn't been approved yet in legislature in Canada, Mexico, and here, but we signed the USMCA. There's a letter that explicitly apparently says there can't be tariffs imposed with this agreement on Mexican automobile industry. So it's something that came out of nowhere, but the president often says that he likes tariffs. So he likes the threat of tariffs. He believes that the threat of tariffs has brought the Chinese back to the table, ready to compromise. He probably see this as a way for Mexico to do more to stem the flow of migrants to the border, of drugs to the border. And the new Mexican president has been behaving very quietly. He didn't answer back too promptly. He just said that we're going to do our stuff. We're going to continue controlling the borders. President claims changes have happened on the Mexican side, but the Mexican foreign minister was here in town this week, and he said, we haven't done anything. There's nothing we have changed, but if he's happy with this, so much the better.
You can't forget the political aspect of this, too. I mean, for Trump, immigration is an issue that appeals to his political base. He is trying to keep these folks on his side. He knows he's got a tough election coming up, and so anytime he can use this issue to rile up the base, he's going to, and going after immigrants is just, it works for him on a political level.
Where do things stand meantime with this border wall?
It depends on who you ask. I think if you ask Trump supporters, they think parts of it are already being built. Other people will say that that's not quite how things are working out. As far as last I checked, they haven't given him the funding he wants, the billions of dollars that he wants to build an actual border wall. It's not really happening on the scale that I think the president would want.
It's interesting if you look quickly, Richard, sort of, you know, the president is, we're about 2.5 years into his four-year term here. He originally said, of course, that Mexico would pay. That didn't work out. He now wants the American taxpayer to pay. Even Republicans in Congress don't want to give him the money for that. And again, he's well into his four-year term here. Is it possible that he's going to get to any of this wall that he wants? And how do you even define a wall? Is it just this fencing, this barrier? It's certainly not this tall concrete structure that he talked about during his campaign.
No, it's going to be, I quote him, a nice and beautiful wall. And now we're talking about something that's not going to be that horrible. But I really, my impression, being at the White House on a daily basis, Paul, my impression is that the president, by keeping this topic in the news in all sorts of different ways, just again answer back to his supporters saying, you see, I'm fighting for this. Everybody is stopping us from doing it because he makes it a collective project. But I think he's going to have a certain number of miles done, new fences and kind of walls built here and there. And I think he will be able to show up during the presidential campaign and say, I promise I would do it. I'm doing as much as I can, but look how things are tough in Congress. We need Republicans in the Senate, back in the Senate, and we have to take back the House. And so, as not clear the success he's had with the wall can be, can appear, I think it is a very successful, as we say in France, cheval de bataille. It's a very nice horse to climb on for him and to go ahead, go in front of his voters and supporters and say, look, at least I'm fighting for it.
So I'm hearing the same thing for both of you, that this is all about firing up his base ahead of 2020. That's the message that I'm hearing. Let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a minute.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you'd like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Richard LaTendresse, White House correspondent for TVA Nouvelle, and Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Our moderator is Washington correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports, Paul Brandes.
Welcome back. For the last 2 years, Republicans controlled the White House and both chambers of our legislature, the House and the Senate, but they were still unable to come up with something to replace the so-called Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as it's more commonly known. Now the Republicans say they won't come up with anything until after the 2020 election. Nahal, why the delay?
Well, for one thing, the Democrats now control the House. And Republicans know that getting any sort of legislation through that they want is going to be nearly impossible. And for the president, President Trump wanted to have, he's been saying that the Republican Party will be the party of health care. We're going to come up with an alternative to Obamacare. You know, his administration has decided not to defend Obamacare in court. And yet the Republican Party is realistic enough to be telling him, look, we're not going to get anything done because the Democrats control the House. And should I also add, they don't really have a plan. And they haven't not only had a plan for healthcare for the last 2 years, they haven't had a plan for healthcare for the last 9 years, right? I mean, this has been going on since the Obama administration, since the start of the Obama administration, and the Republican Party has yet to put forward an alternative that most people find workable when it comes to healthcare. So, you know, they have now some time to come up with something that might pass, you know, branches that they control, or who knows? Who knows who will control those after 2020?
And again, for the last 2 years, Richard, they had everything. They had the White House, they had the House, they had the Senate, and as Nahal pointed out, they came up with nothing, and now they're gambling that come 2021 they're going to be in a stronger position. They already had 2 years where they had everything.
Absolutely. They had the legislative ability to pass something if they had something. There's obviously no alternative, neither offered by the GOP nor or the elected Republicans nor by the White House. At the White House, we asked the president constantly, and he claims, the president himself and his the people around him, that the Republicans in Congress are working on something, are working on a plan, are writing something down. We can't see nothing clear. And I think as much as in the Senate, they do not have, in the House, they don't have the votes. But in the House, if anything were to pass, the Democrats would push something that the Republicans in the Senate would never accept. So there's a total dead end in this case.
Help me understand one thing, and I'll let you take a stab at this, Nihal. One big part of Obamacare, and one reason why so many people have continued to support it, is because of this provision that it would mandate coverage for pre-existing conditions. In other words, if you are sick before you get an insurance policy, they have to give you a policy. You have to have coverage. That, not surprisingly, is really popular, and the Republicans want to take that away. From a political standpoint, taking something away from voters is, to me, not the definition of good politics.
Well, look, it depends on which Republicans you talk to. I mean, some are pretty open that they don't think this pre-existing condition thing is a good idea for insurance companies, businesses. Others say, oh, no, we're gonna make sure to keep that because we know that that's very popular. But one thing to also remember along all this, you're right, that's a very difficult issue. But the issue of healthcare is one that affects voters. And a lot of people believe that the reason that the Democrats did so well in the 2018 midterm elections was because they ran on healthcare as an issue. And they warned that the Republicans would try to take away people's healthcare. So when the president tries to bring this up as a political issue now, you know, the Republicans just lost a bunch of seats, largely because of this healthcare issue. And they're like, look, we don't want to mess with this, especially this pre-existing conditions aspect, which is so very, very popular.
Now, does that explain the delay until after the 2020 election?
I mean, that in theory, yeah. I mean, I think he's saying, look, we're going to do this later. He's hoping that maybe that'll drive people to put Republicans back in power. But very much it could be a double-edged sword. Democrats will likely use this as an issue again for 2020 because they see it as a winner for them.
What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think it's going to be, at the moment, it sounds to me like an illusion. He's going to say, you should vote for us. We'll have a plan and we're going to work on this. We're going to put this in place afterwards. At the moment, we haven't seen anything. I just want to underline an interesting dynamic, by the way, for our listeners. In the corridors of power in Washington, D.C. this week, the president himself boasted in front of Republicans on Tuesday, there was an event, that he didn't consult the leaders in Congress. And Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in the Senate, and Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader in the House, both came after the president, said, no, we do not have anything. We don't want to vote on anything on health care because we do not have anything. And the president said, they didn't like me for it. Now they like me. So it shows that the president starts with an idea and he goes ahead without even consulting the Republican leaders in Congress.
To see how politically feasible it might be.
How politically feasible it might be. What do we have to offer to Americans? He does not think this way. And then there's a sort of a mixture of clash and malaise because obviously they're not on the same page. And we're not talking about the president with his rivals on the Democratic side. We're talking about the same party. So are we seriously thinking that after the election, were they to win back the House and keep the Senate, they would and keep the White House, succeed to score points there?
I think Nihal's made one of the best points here is that they haven't come up with anything in nearly a decade here, and yet he wants
nothing to, that's really viable.
Nothing that's viable.
Yeah, they've come up with some plans, but they've not done very well.
Nothing that's viable. That's the key phrase here. Well, finally this week, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, better known as a NATO in the vernacular, marks its 70th anniversary, 70 years now for our listeners around the world who might not know. NATO was formed way back then because in the first half of the 20th century, there were two world wars that both started in Europe, 1914, 1939. Europe has been stable more or less ever since. But the question is, how strong is that alliance today? Some people seem to have doubts about it, Nihal.
Yes, and those people include President Trump. I mean, there is a sense that NATO has kind of lost its edge on a number of levels. Russia is certainly doing everything it can to try to weaken what it sees as a threat to Russian domination. The Russians in particular are upset that NATO has expanded so much, bringing in a number of Eastern European countries that they view as they should be more under Russian influence as opposed
to former members of the Warsaw Pact.
Correct. And so you have this alliance that is rising, that is struggling in a number of ways. And forget Russia for a second. I mean, there's also China. And then you have President Trump, who, generally speaking, has a very transactional point of view when it comes to international relationships. He doesn't really look at alliances in terms of values. It's more like, well, what are we doing for you? And what are you doing for us? And are we getting a better deal or not? Now, the thing about Trump that's interesting, though, when it comes to NATO is his argument is that other NATO member countries should be spending more on defense and not relying so much on the United States is one that previous presidents, Democratic and Republican, have also been saying for years and years and years. Trump just has gone further than any. I mean, he has made the threat privately that maybe the U.S. should even quit NATO, which would essentially be a death blow to the organization. But in being so harsh on this issue of spending, he has, to some extent, forced some of these countries to step up and spend a little more. Now, there's going to be some people who are going to say, look, they were already increasing their spending ahead of time. They agreed in 2014 under Obama this was going to happen. But I do think there's a strong contingent who feels like Trump's insistence on this has sped things up, has catalyzed this. And in any case, you know, the NATO chief, John Stoltenberg, is happy to give Trump credit for the additional spending because he knows that that's going to make the president happy and maybe get the president to back off a little bit on his criticism of NATO.
Richard, it's fair also to point out that, and Nihal alluded to this, some of the president's criticism of NATO is merited when you look at things like, for example, this controversial German gas pipeline with Russians. Now, that's something that's also been talked about for actually going back to the 80s, I think, when the Reagan administration first voiced concerns about it. But Trump has gotten very vocal about it. If you see Russia as the threat, why, with something like a pipeline, would you make yourself more energy dependent upon it? That seems like a fair point.
It seems like a fair point. My hesitation, however, is that I'm old enough to remember the 80s when there was far more cohesion within the NATO alliance, and of course the enemy was clear, the Soviet Union, the communist bloc. But even if there were tensions within the alliance, you wouldn't attack, you wouldn't go after one of the members so clearly as they do now. For instance,
In public.
Germany with the gas agreement with Russia, but also Germany for its contribution to the budget. And the Germans, it's actually very interesting. The more the president, and we heard the vice president, really going after Germany this week, they answer back, well, our defense budget is going to go down. They're not bending under this type of pressure. And also the other member, Turkey, finger pointed because of the fact that they are part of the consortium. They're working on with the F-35 jet fighter, a very sophisticated fighter that we have, but they buy on the side this missile defense S-400 from Russia.
Right. Yeah.
We can disagree, we can discuss. Obviously, it looks like a major challenge to the alliance, but to try to shame Turkey into backing down. Well, what was the answer of the Turkish foreign minister? It's like, it's a done deal. Live with it.
Yeah, the Turks' argument is basically like, look, we don't actually feel like we have to choose between Russia and the West. And frankly, you know, Turkey has been an issue in NATO for quite a while now. I mean, the country is increasingly authoritarian. It's not exactly a democracy. And it's just, this is going to be a problem that's going to linger, I think, well into the next administration. There's genuine questions as to whether Turkey really, you know, feels like whether Turkey is a type of member state that NATO really aspires to have.
It's just because it's so well situated for the alliance just south of Russia like this. It's hard to let this go because I think strategically...
it's proximity to Syria and Iran and
The Turks know this and they're going to take advantage of every side, as I think any country would do. I mean, this is realpolitik, right? You're just going to do what works to your advantage as a country.
Well, we'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Richard LaTendresse. He's with Canada's TV8 Nouvelle, and Nahal Tusi. She's with Politico. This program was produced by The Voice of America Current Affairs. Our engineer, Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and Westbring Reports. Thank you for listening.